I'm here in Bonboy in the Keeper's Arms, and I'm talking to Oliver Brady. Oliver, I'm back talking to you again, and I suppose to continue from where we left off the other day, we were talking about your farm and your area. So you were saying that it became...
It was originally owned by a McKiernan family. They would have been fairly well connected here. They emigrated sometime in the late 30s, about 37, 38. It was bought by a neighbour from over the road. It actually was the railway line that time, but it's been since converted. They were about a mile away. They were McGee's. The McGee's were a pretty widespread Protestant family. Some of them were involved in the Orange Order way back, maybe in the 1900s, and... But anyway, Robert McGee, there was two Roberts. There was Big Robert and Red Robert. I think this guy was Big Robert. Bought the farm in about 1938. He had three daughters. Iris, who married a local man from the village here, John Brown. And there were two others, Vera and Josie. Josie married a guy called Jemison, I believe Walter Jemison. And the other sister may have married, and as I said, another brother. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty certain that he was a brother of Walter's. I can't think of his first name. In 1949, Robert died, I believe, and the girls decided, well, they weren't married at the time, but they were. Or they were maybe married in around that time, but the three girls decided to move north. The Jemisons came from Thillick, Fintan area in County Tyrone. They moved down to Tyrone, and John Brown and Iris decided to move down to Tyrone as well. And there's another family from up the road, the Gibsons. They moved down coincidentally as well in around the same time.
Well,
now the Gibsons would be just neighbours from McGee's. Apart from just being neighbours, they wouldn't have anything really got to do with the story. I had an uncle and his uncle-in-law, James Crossan. James's family had purchased the farm next door in around 1948-49, and when McGee's farm came on the market, it was convenient, they bought it. I'd say at one stage there was another McKiernan man lived in Crossan's place up till the 20s, funny enough, as well, and another man had bought it and he sold out. So in around the same time the two farms came on the market, and it suited James Crossan to buy the farm off the McGee's. For the short time that the McGee's were... The Crossans bought the place about 1948-49. The McGee's moved away in 1950.
Why did they move?
They married these two northern... Two of the lassies married these two northern guys and moved north. And then John Brown decided to move along. And John and Iris... John Brown and Iris McGee, now Iris Brown, decided to move along with them. Obviously, they just moved as people move when they marry. There was no element.
Okay, but there was no element of...
No, there was none whatsoever. No.
Threatened or anything?
No. Matter of fact, my mother, who was James Crossan's sister, James Crossan was a Republican, he was killed later on, got on very well with the McGee's. And as did James and his brother John. And John actually helped them to move the furniture to Tyrone and went down to Tyrone with them. And there was no
animosity.
No animosity whatsoever. Got on the best. No problem.
Yeah.
No problem.
And?
Years old by, James Crossan and Pat McGinn were involved in the Republican movement. And in the 1950s, the IRA campaign started. James Crossan was an IRA intelligence officer. He was involved in the movement. He was also Sinn Féin organiser of County Cavan, and he was involved from 56 until 58 when he was killed. He was killed in a pretty controversial incident in Swanland Bar.
What happened?
He, on the 24th of August, the 23rd of August 1958, Saturday evening, he was due to organise a Sinn Féin rally or a meeting of some kind in Ballyconnell, and he went down to collect the tricolour in Swanland Bar, himself and a friend, a neighbour, Sean Riley. Sean Riley worked beside him in the creamery. It's an agricultural store now. They met up with a local Republican, Ben McHugh, who had the flag. They were after a day's work. They decided to go socialising. They went to a couple of pubs, and they went to a pub in Swanland Bar. And Swanland Bar was kind of a late town anyway for drinking, and you know, there was, as a lot of rural towns are. But about sometime after midnight, 1 o'clock, they, in the course of their socialising, they met two Northerners. Now, Ben McHugh knew them. James Crossan didn't. One of them was Glover Rooney, a local cattle dealer, and involved in local unionist politics, but a man well known around Swanland Bar. He was a cattle dealer, and the cattle dealer, he was every man's man, and he mixed, and he was well known, and he was from only across the border anyway. His brother was a B special. The other man was Stanley Moffat. He was a B special sergeant. And at that time, there was a system where you had, if your car bonded, you couldn't come into either jurisdiction without having a special bond. I don't know whether it's got to do with tax or insurance or something on your car. So the two northern men had come up to the Lincoln Squad, but they'd left their van on the northern side of the border. So they leaned upon Sean Riley, and there was a local barman there as well, a guy called Tommy McCarron. He ran the bar for his uncle in Swanland Bar where these guys were drinking. And they asked Sean would he drop him down to the border, which was about a mile away, not that far, but and Sean, James Crossan, Ben McHugh, and the three Northerners got into the car. Now, McCarron was a nationalist, a Catholic. And they drove down a couple of minutes run to the border. It was seemed to be social conversation enough. Politics wasn't discussed or anything like that. Sean Riley went about 100, 150 yards of the border, turned his car in a gap, and the other boys decided to get out to stretch their legs. Sean remained on in the car. The five men walked down towards the border, and they seemed to be a while away, and Sean Riley kind of dozed off. And sometime later, he woke up to the sound of gunfire and flares, and obviously knew there was something wrong. Now, he claimed this was about 3 or half 3 in the morning. Now, he would have left them down. Time's escaping now, but it would have been at least an hour and a half before that. And he got out of the car. He, as he said, he had dozed off. He had expected the men to be back in a few minutes, and they didn't. James Crossan and Ben McHugh, he had expected them to come back in a few minutes, and they hadn't come back, but he dozed off, as can happen. Sean had been working hard all day in the creamery, and James Crossan had been actually working on his farm and drawing in here. James Crossan used to do a bit of agricultural contract work as well with a tractor, so there wouldn't have been now, I mean, just, I suppose, relaxing and winding up for the day. But anyway, getting back to the car, Sean got out of the car and he banged, it was a 500-weight van, and he banged the side of the van he saw two men moving about 100, 150 yards away, and they seemed to be approaching him, or approaching the car, and he banged the car and he called them, and as soon as they saw him, they bolted back into the north. And he waited another few minutes, and he got into his car and he drove back. He stopped at Swanland Bar, he stopped at a local bar, not the bar they'd been drinking in, told the barman there was something wrong. He came home, obviously in a panic. He didn't know what was wrong. He actually drove around the country for a while. He didn't know what to do, and he came back home And shortly afterwards, the guards arrived. I asked him, was he in Swanland Bar? He said he was. He with James Crossan and Ben McHugh? And he said he was. And he said the guards told him that Ben McHugh had been arrested and James Crossan had been shot dead. And of course, it created a sensation. The police issued a statement saying that they saw two men approaching the customs hut. They were on patrol, a special patrol. So anyway, the police issued a statement claiming that there were two men coming on a reconnaissance mission to blow up Mullan Customs Hut. You would have gone by Mullan several times. There's no customs hut there now. The customs hut was blown up on many occasions, and it was just a wooden customs hut, but had been blown up. And the joke was, there was a pretty popular customs man in the hut, and every time the hut was blown up, if this guy, Willie White, was in the hut, and the ARA knew he was in the hut, well, they'd give him lots of warning. He was fairly lenient. And every time the hut was blown up, when it was rebuilt, it seemed to approach the border. It was built nearer the border. And Willie kind of maintained that if this had to go on, the border would be in Kerry. But anyway, that's an aside. The police issued a statement saying these two men approached the customs hut. They heard whispering voices. There was a patrol, a routine patrol of B specials at the customs hut, and they saw these two men approaching the hut, and they heard whispering voices. They called them to halt, and they ran, and the police followed them, and they wouldn't stop, and they set up flares and opened fire. But there's nothing of the other three men who would have walked literally past them. You know, there is a booklet, unfortunately. You can get it in Leitrim County Library or Cavan County Leitrim. It's a pamphlet that the Republican movement produced that would... I haven't it at hand because I just handed it to somebody a couple of weeks ago, a copy of it. But anyway...
But it tells
it, that... It tells story. The Republican version. The police gave one version. The Republicans and locals said that couldn't have happened, that they weren't an active service. The Republicans said that James Crossan wasn't an active service. They were doing their neighbours a favour, and that they were just, that James Crossan was, the police were very interested in James Crossan over the years, and that
they shot him.
They shot him. Now the other man who was arrested was Ben McHugh. He was taken away, he was kept incommunicado, and he was in jail, interned in Crumlin Road for 2 years, I think. Ben McHugh was released, very traumatised by the whole thing, never spoke much about it, but was still deeply involved in the Republican movement. About 9 years ago, it was the 50th anniversary of the incident, and I was involved with Republicans in organising a commemoration for James Crossan and Pat McManus, a comrade of his who'd been killed a couple of weeks before in a premature explosion.
What was his name?
Pat McManus.
Oh, yes.
He
was quite a young man.
He was a young man, so was James Crossan. Pat McManus was 27, James Crossan was 26. Hmm. And I, with reluctance, although I knew Ben McHugh quite well and would have lots of dealings with him, he might have mentioned James Crossan in passing, but he never mentioned the incident. And neither did I, but in the course of doing the search for the book, I asked him what happened. Now, he was very reluctant initially to say anything. And then he told me, well, he says, it's the reason why I didn't talk, because it distresses me that much. But he says, this idea that, and this was from probably the one surviving witness, Stanley Moffat may still be alive, I'm not 100% sure. Mm. Well, Sean Riley was alive at that interview, but Sean wasn't, he was 150 yards from the incident, and it was only the aftermath of the incident that he witnessed, the police and the flares and the guns. But what Ben McHugh told me is, Clough Rooney, Stanley Moffat, Tommy McCann and James himself walked down towards the hut, but they stopped at the hut. They stopped just short of the line. They made sure. He says, when we were approaching, we were still on the southern side, when we stopped and we said goodbye to the boys and the party company on the best of terms.
Yeah.
And when we turned round, they were standing behind us. the bee men. They had been hidden in the bushes all round. On the right-hand side of the road is in the north, but on the southern...
So they knew they were coming.
Oh, they knew they were coming. They definitely knew.
And it was an ambush.
It was an ambush. And he said that when James Crossan turned around, he says they just moved in on top of us. He said there come in a dozen of them. Yeah. And he said there's a man standing his ears within a foot of James Crossan, tall policeman. And as soon as James Crossan turned around, the man fired a single shot. Yeah. And he says that wasn't the shot that Sean Riley heard. He says they grabbed me, they dragged me across, brought me down to the hut, rang Kinnolly to get a patrol car up to get me, to transport me to Crumlin Road. But he says they did, and the shots that shot.
Why did they want your uncle dead then?
Because he was an Sinn Féin organiser, and they had and he was an IRA intelligence officer, and he would have been involved in various raids on police barracks in Derry Lynn and Kinnolly and around that area. So well, they actually probably wanted to arrest him. Now, I asked Ben McHugh, I put it specifically to Ben, saying, now, was it an accident or a bit of panic, or was there a struggle? James Crossan shot by a Sten gun, which is a very mass-produced, not very safe kind of machine, submachine gun. And once I put it strongly to Ben, say, maybe it was an accident, maybe the man panicked. Well, he says, I can't say what he did, but he says, to me, it didn't look like a panic. As soon as James Crossan turned around, he shot him.
Imagine.
No.
Well, we've just moved into another room, and I'm just continuing this conversation. The story with your uncle is, did that incident affect... Did your mother ever talk about this?
Oh, we did. It was talked about, definitely. And but it just goes to show the power of the Northern State. The media got, of course, the English media, the tabloids, for want of a better word, Daily Express, that type, they made all these armed raiders attacking the hut, and they ran and they jumped ditches and the, you know, real boy's own kind of stuff. And these police... now, there was an inquest the next day, and the inquest was a farce. Ben McHugh, they could have subpoenaed Sean Riley. Obviously, they got the number of Sean Riley's van and contacted the guards. Mm. Because...
So you were... Because you were... I suppose you grew up...
Well, I was only a kid.
You were only a kid then.
I can remember James Crossan seeing him, but I can remember seeing him once.
But you grew up in that atmosphere.
I didn't, but don't get me wrong, Morris. I was never taught to... We wouldn't be a particularly active political family. And I suppose when the 56 campaign ended, and particularly after James died, it certainly ended around here, because himself and Pat McManus were the two main men. But
memories like that die.
They linger, but they certainly weren't. We didn't get up every morning wishing they would kill every B-man. We always had the best relations with our brothers and neighbours, and a lot of them weren't happy about it.
A lot of people would say that there was a kind of ethnic cleansing going on here. That, you know, they were trying to get rid of Protestants.
There was up in the 50s, there was no, and round here, I'd say around 1920, I'd be guessing at this, but I'd say the split was probably 60-40. Nationalists and Unionists. Ethnic cleansing didn't... Now, I've heard in Cork of stories of ethnic cleansing and all that, but in Bother areas, no. They stayed on. Now, the Orange Order was pretty strong up here until what really did it was, what caused most people to leave was, most Protestants to leave, the same reason as caused a lot of other people to leave, the economics, immigration. Hmm. There was never... I never saw much hassle. I worked for Protestant firms. I worked for Protestant employers. I know lots of Protestants, and okay, there'd be a bit of slagging around the 12th or something like that, but and it'd be all kind of very much nuanced and restrained and a bit of fun or light. But I never noticed any open animosity, and I have as good Protestant friends as I have Catholic friends, and some of them might be of a unionist persuasion. I don't know their politics, I don't care their politics. Their politics or their religion means nothing to me, no matter what football side they follow or whatever. But there wasn't the idea that there was ethnic cleansing going on, certainly in the from the independence till the start of the 69 Troubles. No, I refute that. I'd have to say that the moves for economic reasons, and naturally enough, as a Protestant man did say to me, I was discussing it with a man one time, a local man, a great historian, if too bad he's not around. But he said that basically what happened when the border was formed,
what was his name?
His name was Georgie Galt, but he's dead. He was, when I say historian, he would have been a great historian. He wasn't an historian, he wasn't a professional historian, he was just a great local character, a great man to tell a story. But he discussed it in general one time. And he claimed, well, once they drew the line on the map, there was a pile of unionists stuck on the southern side and a pile of Catholics stuck on the northern side. And obviously, what he said, the Protestant community didn't like it, but they just knuckled under and they put up with it. And but he said that there was never any. There was a couple of incidents, Orange Walk stopped and rows and ructions, but he said that certainly there was one in Newton Gower, which is a local village up the road here, and an Orange Walk stopped there in 1932 by a mixture of Republicans and Blue Shorts and all kinds of lads.
Mm-hmm.
But he said there was no violence at it. We heard of the battle, you know. He said there was no violence at it. There was a drum with a spade put through it or something. But he said that, he says they did block the parade, but he says then as the parade was being blocked, they just turned their backs on the parade, but he said there was enough police and army there to stop violence anyway. But he said that the way Georgie put it was, he says, well, we just put up with it, and he says he never experienced any hassle, but he used to continue to go to parades in the north. And the peculiar thing was about the wee specials, a lot of southern Protestants headed north at weekends to do their stint with the wee specials. Nationalists might have went to the FCA or whatever, but they went north. But you will admit the B specialists and the FCA were slightly different forces. And James Carson would have known B specialists.
Yeah.
He would have socialised with them, he would have walked with them. Now, socialisation mightn't be to the same degree as it is today, where everybody mixes in, but there would be a tendency, you would find it that sometimes, even yet, in certain areas, not very far from here, Protestants tend to associate with Protestants and Catholics tend to associate with Catholics. It's not marked, but...
Yeah, that's... So they... You don't have that same...
There was no sectarianism.
Sectarianism,
No.
But
now,
but,
in Fermanagh, it might be different because the divisions were sharper.
Yeah.
But yet...
Mm.
From what I would know from Fermanagh, the fact was that, I suppose, whether we liked it or not, most unionists were followers of the Protestant faith in various denominations. To be mostly Church of Ireland and here, maybe Presbyterian, less as really Methodists. But I was told, certainly around Talbot in the 1950s, I wouldn't know any of these men or these people, but there were a considerable number of Protestants who did support the Republican movement and were in the Republican movement. But religion played a big part in Ireland until now. We're kind of a post-religious society here in the south now,
yeah,
because of various things. But in the north, it's not. Religion still means a lot in the north. It is still a badge of identity to a certain degree, but there is certainly amongst the more radical Protestant groups, they're not big into ecumenism for a start.
But Oliver, can I ask you a question? When the Troubles broke out,
yeah,
in say the beginning of the 70s,
yeah, 69, yeah.
Did Did you feel that you wanted to take part, that you wanted to to do something about this?
Oh, we felt certain we knew what the North was like, because it was, as far as I'm concerned, it was always an apartheid state. It was.
So did you do anything?
I was involved, yes, but because of family considerations, I had to just... I'm constrained as to what I did or what I didn't do. I'm not prepared to say it, but I certainly knew what was going on and I would have helped out. Put it that way. I don't want to go into any more detail than that. I was certainly a member of Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
But I would know who IRM and where.
And were these people who just had a serious grudge against Protestants
no,
from the North?
I never, amongst most Republicans that I dealt with, I would have not found... I never found them particularly sectarian, but I suppose sectarianism... The problem with sectarianism is that for... And it applies right across the board. Because of our history, unionists tend to be Protestants. Nationalists or Republicans tend to be Catholic. I don't think that the... I think as far as Catholics are concerned, and Nationalists and Republicans, it wasn't the theology of it that really bothered them. It was the fact that unionists were of a Republican ideology, or of a unionist ideology. It was ideology rather than theology. But I think from listening to adherents of unionists, even today, their religion still means a bit. I think at any time, but particularly in this modern age, that who cares what religion you belong to? I'm not religious. I'm not a particularly avid churchgoer. I was at church on Sunday, but it just happened by accident. I was showing a bunch from Wexford around our local Protestant church. I got the key of local Protestant man. They wanted to see the inside of the church, and that's as far as any church I got on Sunday, you know. But at least they couldn't say I wasn't at church, even though there was nobody in it but myself and them. I can ask my Protestant neighbours if they want it. It's a nice church, and a lot of people are interested in the church and the surrounds. I used to do a bit of local tour guiding, and because I know the area fairly well, a lot of people like yourself come to me, and yeah, I get the key, and there's no problem. The local Protestants have no problem letting me into the church.
But then, the local lads.
Well, the local lads, not by and large, I found them. I didn't find them to be particularly sectarian, and they would have drunk with Protestants and dealt with them. And
why were they so violent?
It was the UDO, the B specials. This is something that I suppose you don't get in the South as much. The Unionist state was propped up by... It was a one-party state for a long time. Now, the party, ironically enough, the party that propped it up is in bits now, the official, what we call the official Unionists. But they were arrogant. They loved in your face, big parades. And at that click of a switch, the B-men were called out. And the B-men were local militia. And you know, if you get a local lad and put a uniform on him and send him out, he can get very important all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And he can be officious, and he can be bold, and he can be snotty, and he can be... And if you add a little bit of religious or political needle into it, it gets even worse. And the B-men were notorious, and the UDO. I would have noticed straight away, you'd know the UDO for a start, because the cap badges and the wore longer hair, and some of them had wore moustaches and beards. But you'd know straight away what you were running into when you're running the UDO. They were insulting, officious, bigoted. You wouldn't meet that with the average soldier. Would ask you a few questions and he'd be civil enough. Police, you could meet police who were civil enough, and you could meet police who were working devils.
But the antics of the way the boys carried out their work, they not only shot people, but they actually took them away, and they buried them and told nobody where they were.
Well, I certainly wouldn't approve of that. When I say I don't approve of violence, I can understand what, I suppose, from what happened, our own family. I knew the way the unions worked. Put it this way, there was a complete, state violence is all right, and they could walk all over you. And if you stepped out of line at all, and you remember what they did to the civil rights movement, just ordinary, young, naive students at the batter, and then and one thing led to another, and it is like any row, when it gets out of hand, it's very hard to stop it. And the police were involved in, and the army, and the intelligence service, they were involved in bumping off nationalists. We had James Murphy, he owned a garage, you may have come across the name down there, Derry Lynn. Mm. James Murphy was a quiet, easygoing, well-got, would have Republican connections, but wouldn't be that deeply involved, and he was taken out and shot by UDR. Louis Leonard, he was from Newton Butler, he was shot in Derry Lynn. Now, admittedly, though, UDR people shot as well. But it was a series of, put it this way, I remember in a discussion in the house with local Protestant man, I don't know how the chat came round, it could have been in relation to young Jemison, and he said it shouldn't have happened. I certainly fully agree with him, it shouldn't have happened. What happened, Robert Jemison, shouldn't have happened. But there was lots of things shouldn't have happened. You know, none of it should have happened. And I think there was a tendency, and it's not just confined here in Brazil's, the tendency is when things get hot to shoot first and ask questions after, or it should be the other way around. I think we have matured enough now. I certainly do believe that we owe a lot to, when the movement, there's all kinds of stories as to why and what and why it stopped, why the violence stopped. Stalemate. Nobody was getting anywhere. The British entered negotiations with Republicans to get some kind of a settlement that would get them off the hook. The British were caught. Now, Republicans, I suppose, regard the quote Wolf Tone, British involvement as the source of all our political evils, and I'd be inclined to agree with him. But, and particularly Conservative governments and Unionists always worked hand in glove. But in the last 30 years, the British government realised that the North was only a drain on their military, their finances, everything else. But they still owed a duty of care to Unionists, but they wanted to get shot of it. So they decided that they would. The Republicans were probably spun out after 30 years of a quite long, drawn-out, sophisticated war, because the amount of explosives, mortar attacks, all this was planned. And I know the Republican movement was extremely well organised around here. They would have lost very few men around here, if any. Even to have been captured, there would have been a couple of them would have been caught and done in jail. But by and large, Republicans around here escaped because they were extremely well organised.
Why were they well organised around here?
Just the nature of the people that led them. And they weren't particularly in your face or anything like that, but they were extremely well organised throughout Cavan, Leitrim, Fermanagh. They were very competent units that could launch the attacks and they could come back.
When you said that the intelligence down here was very good, mm. They kind of knew, how did they know? How did they know their Northern Ireland? You were just describing there how you spot an...
Well, there is a thing. It's a thing. It doesn't want... It's regardless. You, around these parts, where you are in mixed company, you can nearly know, it's whether it's body language, we all look much the same, but now most people here, I'd say, would be able to pick out to be blunt about it, a Protestant by looking at them, and vice versa. Same as if you were in London, particularly with the older generation, You go into an Irish pub, or you go into a pub in London, and particularly with older people, judging by their movement, their body language, it's all a question of body language. I didn't discuss. Now, you nearly spot the Irish there. I was in San Francisco, and I was walking down the street, and there were gangs of boys walking there who my brother knew. Now, there could have been Poles, Russians, everything else, but I knew they were Irish. I automatically knew by looking at them that they were Irish. It was something I can't explain. It's like body language, maybe it's nuanced, I don't know.
But were people from here scared to go across the border for the same reason, that they would be spotted and they would be known? Or,
well, now, Republicans would be very careful going across it, but people who wouldn't be involved, they didn't like the hassle, but they didn't seem to bother them. Enniskillen people always went to Enniskillen. People always went to Derry Lynn. People always carried out. Now, they might run into incidents and they might be stopped and searched and hassled and harassed, but no. Now, Republicans would be very careful. I would have gone to Enniskillen out of business and shopping and stuff like that, but I'd be always a bit wary. Now, obviously, I was stopped by police, UDR. They didn't say or do really much to annoy me. But my brother would have been hassled a few times.
Was your brother also involved?
No, he wasn't. He'd no interest in. He might be on the fringes, but he wasn't. Certainly, he wouldn't be. But he certainly he was involved. A couple of incidents where they were pretty nasty to him and his friends, both police and UDR.
So, Oliver, can I ask you, if you could reverse the clock, would you have made any changes? Would you have still been as involved as you were involved? Would you?
Put it this way, if you could do a lot of things twice, you'd do them, they'd be done better. But that's a rhetorical question. I'd be a lot more circumspect. I believe that the one thing, despite all the hiccups with the peace process at the minute, I think instead of fighting the weight of it, people are going to have to take the weight of it now. You know, that's what I would see. And I don't think there's any desire, apart from an odd lunatic, to go back. Because I think the area did fight themselves to a standstill, but they did fight the system, and they did fight the unionists to a standstill, and the British. The problem was, and an old member of the old UVF, I remember in the course of a conversation one day at the local creamery, I don't know, they either check him round, and he probably said the truth. He said that if they had to settle it in 1916 or 1921, we wouldn't have to be having this chat today. And this was this guy was a very active UVF man in his time. And that was the problem. Unionists would not talk. They had the blessing of the British government in the Plaid Asquith and all these guys, conservatives offered. The orange card was in Randolph Churchill. The orange card is the one to play. They played the orange card. The British establishment backed unionists. They wouldn't listen to nationalists, and they would not talk. If they could help, they didn't want to talk. They didn't want to discuss the future. And history repeats itself. You go back to 1798. 1798 didn't start as a way mad Republican rebellion. In the 1790s. There's an outfit called the Catholic Committee, who, ironically, most of them are Protestants, some Presbyterians. I don't think there's any Catholics on this Catholic Committee, but they were kind of a civil rights committee that were trying to get a better deal for mainly Presbyterians and Catholics, and they were just ignored. And we'll bull on, and we'll plow on, and we'll. And the more you're rejected, and if you get out of bounds and they start to put down the boot, you'll hit back. It's action and reaction. And the actions of the authorities was to plough in, and then you had the whole issue of land, landlordism, go to the 1913 lockout, a kind of a similar situation where
but during no during your lifetime
but my lifetime
and, yes and yeah. working in as you were and, in you were farming, isn't that what you told
I
me?
Did, no I wasn't, it was my brother's farm, and I worked in industry, I worked at various jobs, worked at the council, worked in, I wasn't a farmer, I did a bit of farming, but more or less.
But it was always working in this area.
I would walk in this area, and I would have walked all around, and I know the area pretty well, and I know a lot of people.
And do you think that that it was a good place to live at that time?
Yes, it was. I always enjoyed living around here. I never had any problem living around here. And I think it's...
Do you think you escaped most of the troubles then?
We did. We escaped quite well around here. Generally, side of the border, it didn't impinge that much side of the border, apart from, well, the hassle of checkpoints and guards and soldiers, and there was that element that you'd... If you hadn't your car touched, you could run into a lot of bother, or if you had a few pints in you, that kind of thing. But it was more or less an inconvenience rather than you just... We were inconvenienced rather than harassed, we'll say, in this area now. But when you ask me, I suppose, would I have done things different? The frank answer is I don't know. Probably yes.
What changes?
I'd think a lot harder, and I'd... I would try to reach out, maybe, or advise people to try to reach out and negotiate. But then at that time, they weren't prepared to negotiate. Unionists wouldn't talk to Republicans, and Republicans were always amenable enough to talk and discuss things. But it was the terrorists and the terrorists and the terrorists. They're talking about what the state was doing. Like it was the North of Ireland was an armed camp from the day it was founded till 20 years ago, you know. So
it's been a very interesting story. But the big question here is the people who were hurt by the troubles.
I feel sorry for anybody that was hurt. I never gloated on anybody's death, but. See, it's a modern cliche where there's lack of change in religion. People look for closure and want closure on this and closure on that and closure on the other. But sometimes closure just doesn't come, or you just have to make your own closure. You know what I mean? We'd all love to know exactly what happened. I'd love to know exactly what happened. Why did James Carson go down that morning? Why did he? Now, he knew the guys he was with, but then he didn't know the guys, but Ben McKee did know them. So obviously Ben McKee trusted them.
But he was living by the sword.
He was living by the sword. And he was living by the sword, you could say that, but he certainly wasn't living by the sword that night. He was obliging. He was party to obligement of two men that want to lift down to the border. So you see, it's...
Do you think it was a huge waste of life, though? The fact that he was shot and killed?
Waste. I think if... that's a very difficult one. Funny enough, the Northern coroner said he threw his life away. It was a very biased inquest. The inquest was a farce, and the inquest, the coroner said, well, he threw his life away. Now, my argument, and the Republican argument, would be he didn't throw it away, it was taken from him. No. He certainly hadn't intended to go down to, like, if he... You might say, had he... I suppose the fact that he was involved, there was always the danger. But if he had been involved in a wholesale attack on the police post and fire back, you'd say, well, okay, fair play. There were better shots or whatever, you know. But that's my attitude. Like, I think that we will have to draw sooner or later a line under it and try and plough on as best we can.
And how would you like to see the legacy of the Troubles written?
Well, I'd like to see set up, some kind of play set up where it would be most unlikely that it ever happened again. I think, you see, it's a question of perception. If unionists are up in arms now because they think that nationalists have got too much, and it's rather illogical that instead of we are losing, you're winning.
Yeah.
But where you have peace and when you're able to sit down and behave in a civilized people, it's a win-win. Mm. I think the peace process is win-win. It depends what way you want to handle it. But this thing, it's this whole issue about the Irish Language Act and everything else. Now, I'm not an Irish speaker myself. I would have learned it at school. I think the authorities since the 1920s went the wrong way, but then, that was then. It was, like, for somebody who wants to learn Irish, from a purely grammatical point of view,
yeah,
Irish is a very difficult language to learn. You know, but if you could inculcate some kind of respect and thinking it, but if you're trying to learn off your Irish grammar, or indeed any other grammar, but I would have studied French, Latin, English, Irish, German to a lesser extent.
My goodness.
And of the three, German would be very, but of the two languages that grammatically that I found most difficult to master was English and Irish. English isn't so bad because we're speaking it, and Irish grammar I found notoriously difficult to learn. Now, there's ructions with Irish language acts and Ulster Scots and the whole lot, which is... I can understand fully where the nationalists are coming from if they want.
But it's a debate every single morning you turn on the radio.
It's a debate.
You hear it.
And then
Sinn Féin wanting all the signs.
Yeah.
In Irish.
It wouldn't really worry me what language are in. Ulster Scots is another one. Is it language? Is it a dialect? It's certainly a dialect that would have impinged on our version of English. Now, we don't speak Ulster Scots here, but we use a lot of Ulster Scots words and Irish words.
Yeah.
But what makes me wonder is Ulster Scots a language in that I could go into places where I've heard it spoken, particularly around North Armagh and East Donegal, and yet I can understand most of it. So obviously, and yet I don't speak it. You know.
You're an amazing man. I appreciated this interview very much. You were very frank with me, and
But as I told you, there's certain elements that I couldn't be that frank about. But to me,
someday you will. I'll just
sum it up.
Yeah.
To me, a person's religion never meant anything to me. I went to school with Protestants. I worked with Protestants. Protestant church beside me. My neighbours went to the church. We went to Mass. We might bump into the after Mass. The difference was there, and we accepted it. But you and I don't know what vintage you are, but I'm 62. I never really saw Catholicism. It was in transition when I was growing up. But if you have preacher men standing up, it doesn't matter if there's a priest, a rector, a Free Presbyterian, preaching sectarian theological nonsense out of a pulpit, and that your Protestant neighbours going to go to hell, which I never believed. I regarded my Protestant neighbours as immoral and as good living, and maybe in a lot of cases better living than I was. I always admired a lot of them for their honesty and straight dealings. Now, you might meet other kinful lad among them who would be a real villain, but anyway, that's human nature. But if you're up raving and blathering about theological points, communion and worshipping statues, and that if you I put it this way. If you're going to tell your congregation that you're Catholic neighbours for the sake of a, and I'm not just singling out Protestants, the same, as I said, would apply to a priest coming out of the same nonsense, that your Protestant neighbour's going to go to, or that your Catholic neighbour's going to go to hell, and he's an idolater, and he's a fornicator, and he's this, that, and other, and he's bound, he's not saved, he's not biblical, he's not this, he's not that, he's not the other, and he's going to go to hell. Well, it might, you'd be in a dilemma when you'd be meeting him out on the street. Are you going to make life comfortable for him when he's here, or are you going to give him hell on earth to just get him? When he does go to hell, he'll be well prepared for it. You know, that's. Yeah. And I've heard preacher men and listened to nonsense of every kind from every. I've heard egos of clergymen, and I've heard egos of Roman Catholic priests as well. You know.
Oliver Brady, listen, thank you. It's been an experience. Thank you.